All right, so let's get started. Welcome to ChemAI ML 2017, the Artificial Intelligence and Machine Learning in Cambridge event. We have been organizing this event for 4 years now. This is the fourth time that we organize this event, but I have to say I'm impressed with the turnout. This is the largest turnout by far. But I can assure you we have provision for enough coffee and food in the lunch break, so we can accommodate. So first off, thanks to my co-organizers, Miguel Hernandez and Zubin Garamani. So it's a great pleasure here to organize this in Cambridge. It's great to see that the Cambridge machine learning community grows every year, and there's new startups and new companies setting foot here in Cambridge. That's really good. Let me say a few more words, the boring stuff that I have to say. There are some fire exits. There's one over here and one on the top, the one you came in through. And in case there's a fire alarm, which is unlikely, but in case there is, please remain calm and exit through these fire exits. I also would like to thank the administrative support that we have received here, in particular Sarah Roberts, who has done an amazing job to organize everything here, from the food catering to booking all the rooms to making the badges. And also Nailchir for doing the website, and Luke and Natasha for helping out with the organization. Unfortunately, some of the badges have the wrong affiliation. This is not a hint that you suddenly joined MSRC or something. So I apologize for that. I don't know exactly how that happened, and we will try to rectify that. The talks are, the couple of sessions, the talks have a 20-minute time limit, and so you can have 15-minute talks and then a few minutes for questions, or 70-minute talk and 3-minute questions. But there's a 20-minute hard time limit, and I will make sure we enforce that time limit. So roughly the agenda is as follows. This is an academic event, so we just have basically academic sessions interrupted by coffee breaks or the other way around. And then we have a 1-hour lunch in the middle, and then we conclude hopefully at 5. So without further ado, I think the first speaker can set up. The first session is actually a Microsoft session, and then we have a full university session as session 2. It's Alex Gaunt, who recently joined us as researcher here in the group. Talking about program synthesis.
Okay, hi. I'm Alex Gaunt. I'd like to talk today about learning to code. It's something we've all done. But in particular, I'd like to talk about how machine learning can be used for program synthesis. So I'll begin by describing a couple of stereotypes. So program synthesis has a long history in the programming languages community, and I'll describe the stereotypical programming languages synthesizer in this blue box. And then there's this newfangled thing, deep learning, that everyone's very excited about. I'll describe the stereotypical deep learning system in this orange box. So a typical program synthesizer will take something like some sort of specification, which may be some logical expression, or it could be just some input-output examples for what the program should do to some inputs. And it will try to output source code that is in some way interpretable by either a machine or a human, which is able to explain and fit those specifications. Deep learning, on the other hand, is all about taking input-output examples again and trying to come up with some sort of black box function, so a neural network that contains many floating point weights. It's not necessarily interpretable like source code is, but it just turns does some black box operation on inputs to turn them into outputs. So some other differences between these two types of stereotypes is that a traditional synthesizer often works on very low-level data types like Booleans, integers, and so on, whereas deep learning is often associated with these sort of perceptual data types like images and speech. And in order for these black box functions to generalize well, you often need a big data set in order to train them. And finally, a big difference between these two areas is that often the old-fashioned programming languages approach is to use some sort of combinatorial method to find the source code that fits the specification, so enumerative search or constraint solving, whereas deep learning has this very, very nice gradient descent algorithm. It's very, very sort of efficient, easy to parallelize, and it works really well for searching over these black box functions. So those are the stereotypes. But how can we sort of mix these two things together? What does deep learning have to offer for synthesizing programs? So what approach should we take? Should we start designing new deep learning models which have some sort of program structure built into them, but ultimately learn from input-output examples using gradient descent? Is that the way we should merge these two fields? Or should we keep the two systems separate and we have some sort of discrete search algorithm and we provide a deep learning heuristic to guide that search? Is that the approach we should take? So I'd like to talk about these two separate approaches, and I'll start by describing our attempts to come up with some new sort of hybrid new models that look a lot like programs but learn by gradient descent. So this avenue of program structured models was kind of a lot of excitement was generated by this model, the neural Turing machine. And kind of the big idea behind the neural Turing machine was to take one of these black box neural networks and attach it to some sort of interpretable, differentiable analog of computer memory. And this idea of attaching neural networks to memory sparked a lot of interest, and there's been a lot of work recently on these more structured models. So what does it mean to have a differentiable model of memory access? So here's a discrete memory. You have some pointer which looks into some cells of memory, and for the models that I'll describe, these cells contain some discrete data types, so integers or enums or something. All the models I'll describe act over these discrete data types. And to move the pointer from position 3 to position 2, you just update this discrete value. You can imagine turning this into a continuous operation by saying, rather than having a discrete pointer, we have a distribution over possible pointer values, and inside each entry in the memory, we have a distribution over possible values that are stored in those cells. And so we can do a continuous update of the pointer position, and since this update is continuous, the whole process is differentiable. So we can imagine reading memory in this continuous representation is just a case of pulling all of the distributions out of memory and taking a weighted sum according to the pointer distribution. But note that the continuous representation does still capture the discrete case if you just have a point mass at a particular position. So the idea is that we're going to do some sort of learning in this continuous regime, and we hope that at convergence we reach some sort of discrete solution which we can then interpret as a discrete actions or some sort of program. Another way of looking at this is that you have some sort of factor graph, but this factor graph is very special in that all edges, you just have marginal distributions moving along edges. And inside a factor, you do some sort of computation, and then marginal distributions come out. So since you're never keeping track of a full joint distribution, you remove all the correlations, you just have this, you don't get a combinatorial explosion, but you just have marginal distributions moving around. So where does our contribution come in? So we designed this language, Turprit, which is a probabilistic programming language for program synthesis. And the idea of Turprit is to take this sort of differentiable memory model and to apply it to every single operation inside a program interpreter. So whenever a function is applied inside a program interpreter, we just lift it to this continuous representation where we have marginals flowing in and out. Whenever there's a conditional branch, we just say, so say y could either be a or b, depending on some switch function. We take the marginal values of a, the marginal values of b, we compute the marginal value of y based on a weighted sum according to this switching variable. So all the operations inside a program interpreter can be lifted to this continuous regime. And so what does it look like to write an interpreter in this language? Well, imagine the very, very simplest possible case. You have an instruction set that consists of just the identity function and the addition function, where the addition is parameterized by some constant c. And we want to infer a program of the form y is some function applied to x parameterized by some constant. So a very, very simple example. And in the Turprit language, this looks like this. Basically, the important bits at the bottom here. It's just if the instruction is 0, then y is equal to x. So that's applying the identity operation. If the instruction is 1, then y is x plus a constant. This code is basically encoding a factor graph which looks like this. And if I give you some input-output example, like 4 goes to 6, then we can send these marginals around this graph, and sure enough, after learning, we end up with that y is the addition of x and 2. So we've inferred a very simple program there. And if you believe that this is possible, then it's not much of a stretch from the imagination to go to the case where the interpreter is a Turing machine, or digital circuits, or a simple assembly language. And it just takes a couple of screens of code in this interpret language to describe these fully differentiable models. So the nice thing about Turpret is we have this long history in the programming languages community of synthesizing programs, and we've come up with this gradient descent method. But it would be good if we could compare gradient descent to all these other sort of constraint solvers and even sort of bespoke program synthesis frameworks from history. And so what we have is we have one model specification in this interpret language, and we can compile it to all these different optimization backends so that we can do a fair comparison of all these different methods. And when it comes to the results, so here we have all the various different models at the top, so some Turing machine or assembly or whatever. We have various different tasks, so invert all the symbols on a Turing tape or access a linked list in assembly language. Various things to try, and we time how long it takes for each system to solve to synthesize the program that solves the task. So gradient descent is shown in red, and the various constraint solvers are in blue. And you can see that gradient descent is actually not doing a great job. And this story is repeated across the board. So the reason gradient descent doesn't do very well is it's a very non-convex optimization problem, and so it gets stalled into local minima very often. And so kind of the conclusion from this little section of work is that, yeah, sure enough, we can make models which produce interpretable source code, and they learn by gradient descent. But traditional synthesizers are doing way better than a sort of deep learning style approach. This comes with a caveat that traditional synthesizers require small, noiseless, and discrete input-output examples. So one avenue where you could imagine deep learning has an edge is, say you wanted to synthesize a program that solved this problem, where you're given a grid of images, you need to count, you're given an initial starting point, you need to count the length of the path through this grid of images. Well, you could do that if you had some function look, but this look needs to analyze images, and so you'd expect that this look function actually has a neural network behind it. So you look, you move, you increment, that would be a program just to count the length of this this path. Or imagine some other situation where you had handwritten digits and operators and you needed to evaluate this handwritten expression. Again, to understand these pictures, you'd need a neural network, and then there'd be some program to actually apply this neural network. So in our fully differentiable setting, we can actually just take an instruction set and add neural networks to the end of it. And then once we have this library of neural networks in our instruction set, we can learn everything together, simultaneously learning a program and neural networks. And we call this just sort of differentiable programs with neural libraries. And the advantage of this sort of technique over just a purely neural, just showing the problem to an unstructured neural network is that we found that the added structure of a program leads to much stronger generalization than a pure neural network, and the added structure also allows modularity. So we consider this library of neural networks, and we can apply those neural networks when the task requires it, and when the task doesn't require it, we can shut off gradients to those neural networks, so we don't have the problem of catastrophic forgetting, which is often associated with sort of lifelong learning or multitask learning in typical neural networks. So that was kind of a very whistle-stop tour of how you might want to combine these sorts of systems. But what about the other idea of just using neural networks as a guide for an existing enumerative search strategy? So the high-level idea here is, say you have some input-output example and you have a neural network, and you hope that the program which explains your input-output example is somewhere in some program space that you've defined by a domain-specific language. And the role of the neural net is just to say, try searching somewhere here first. And then you'll hand that job off to an enumerative search algorithm, which just is initialized with the search position in roughly the right place. So we did some experiments with this kind of idea using a simple link-like domain-specific language. So we have various functions like sort and drop and count, and you can see them all there. And the reason we chose this language was if you look at very simple programming language competitions, they have these sort of text tasks, and you can turn these into input-output examples, and the program is solved by some very simple program which is very easily expressed in this link-like language. So to train this system, we just randomly generate a program in our language, and then we randomly generate some inputs and compute the outputs on those inputs. And then we show these inputs and outputs to a neural network. I don't know why my neural networks always get duplicated, but so we show those input outputs to the neural networks, and then the neural network is trained to point out which instructions were present in the program that generated the input output examples. So we repeat that with a million random input outputs and a million random programs. Then we show a new unseen input-output example to our neural network, and it's able to suggest which programs were present, which instructions were present in the program that generated this input-output. And once it's suggested which instructions should be present, it's kind of given ordering over the program space that the enumerative search should start to search over, and then the search can produce the final program here. So it turns out that this method, actually, we tried it on various sort of state-of-the-art synthesizers. We added this new deep learning heuristic to them, and we got huge speed-ups of, in some cases, like almost 500 times. So kind of the high-level output of all this work is that currently deep learning is usually actually best placed as an augmentation to, rather than a replacement for, the existing highly tuned synthesis systems. And this kind of echoes a sentiment that is people have found in the deep math line of work. So I think this is work by Google on trying to use deep learning for automatic theorem proving, where they've also found that it's no good to just try and replace all of the years of work on automatic theorem proving with deep learning systems, but actually they want to use deep learning as just another heuristic inside these highly tuned search algorithms. So that's the... That's the end. And,
Thanks for staying on time. We do have time for questions as a result.